Okay. It's running. It's running. Can y'all hear me?
You did it?
I can hear you. Yeah, you. There you are.
Can you hear me?
Yay, you're here.
Yay, you're here. Hooray.
Somebody else had that that mat that you had, the yay, you're here. And I was like, oh, Amanda.
Oh, yes. I love it so much. I still have, it's very faded, but I still have it.
Tammy, I assure you, if and when we ever do decide to record video, it will be when my internet is a little stronger, because right now you're frozen with this horrified look on your face, and you can assure yourself that I will have my ring light, because I look like I'm sitting in a cave of shadows at the moment.
Maybe I was just sitting like that for a long time.
I think you still
are. Maybe she was.
Like, your mouth is open like you're asking a question. I should take a screenshot of this.
No.
Oh, man, you moved.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's fine.
Okay.
Mercy. Yeah, I don't sound that bad. I sound a little congested, but I don't sound that bad.
You sound great.
You sound way better than you did this morning.
That's good.
So the reason that we're recording separately today, this time, and for the next couple of episodes is because the industry that Tam and I work in, education, this is one of the busiest times. And so we don't live that close together, and we didn't have a free week and we could all meet up. And then our sweet little Amanda's a little under the weather as well. So for the sake of remaining safe and non-contagious, she's sequestered in her room.
I am trapped in my little humble abode.
Yeah.
you were
just accidentally quarantined for this.
Yeah, no.
I know that somebody needed a quarantine.
Yeah, right. I'm playing this.
Okay. You can't do segues like quite as naturally when you're not in the same room. I'm like, do I pause for them to talk or just go the typical Aaron Wayne style? Everyone, what's the best way forward?
I forgot how awkward this is, because the only thing I do on video chat now is ARDS, and those are just awkward anyway. So
I'm quite used to this actually, because therapy is on.
Say that again.
Yeah. No, I'm quite used to it because I do therapy weekly on video, so I'm like, oh, hey, this is normal. Cool.
I actually have gotten so much more used to video chat. Like, I used to really hate FaceTime because it's the same thing. Like, it's awkward. You kind of start to talk at the same time, and then you're like, oh, no, sorry. Oh, you go. No, you go. No, I'm sorry. But I think just kind of the light of the last 2 years, we've gotten used to it a bit more. But this computer that I'm on is an absolute dinosaur. Like, it's from my previous job, and so it's probably 7 or 8 years old now, and I don't know if it's the connectivity, because our internet's not very strong, or if both of you just happen to choose filters on your camera that make you extremely blurry, but I have to think it's probably on my end.
Well, Amanda's blurry on mine, but you're not, so for whatever that's worth.
It's interesting, because you're blurry on mine, but Aaron's not. Anyway.
Oh, so maybe I have the superior computer is what we're saying then. My dinosaur is
maybe
really
so.
Up. Well, guys, maybe let's jump so. Into it, because I know that we've got, this is a fairly long one, and then if we have time, we're going to record Tammy's, and if not, we've got to reconvene. So are you guys ready to get started?
I am.
What if you said no? No, not really. I keep clicking back and forth. Okay. Do you guys know what state we're on? I'll give you a hint, kind of a hint. We are not at the very end of the alphabet, but we are getting extremely close, which means we then have to talk about what our show format looks like. That was loud. Oh my God, as I hit everything. We have to talk about what our show format's going to look like when we finish the states, but we are getting kind of close to the end. Do you have any idea where we are?
Well, you have it titled at the top of the window, so yes.
No, I know.
You know what, Tammy? I have never doubted your ability to use context clues. Probably.
Hey, y'all.
So, Tammy, which episode it's Virginia. Are we doing? We're in Virginia. I really should have printed these notes, because I have to keep clicking over to my page with notes, and then I can't see your faces. Okay,
have to do the
let's
same
get
thing.
Started here. Okay, so, and I apologize if you can hear my puppy barking in the background. He's a little annoyed at me, so just pretend that you don't hear a dog barking. We're really professional here. Okay, so, Virginia, When I started researching, one urban legend stood out more than the rest. So you know how normally when we start our searches, it's kind of like there's like five or six that kind of stick out at the top, and depending on the website you click on, like one is higher or the other. Mm-hmm. That was not the case in Virginia. So there's one that just kept showing up, like every piece of research I did. And so I'm only going to cover the one, and it's pretty lengthy. And I'll explain more in a minute why it is so lengthy. But the entire, hold on, Amanda, are you going to be okay? Because this is a scary one. We're not all together. Are you going to be okay?
We're not all together. And Tim's out. Awesome. And no one can save me. Come and save me because I have COVID.
So if you need to dip out early, Tammy and I can finish this episode. Just know. You don't even have to say anything. Like, you can just like wave and jump off the call. Like, we'll give you a pass.
When I'm FaceTiming you guys in the middle of the night, don't be mad at me.
Hey, I won't hear it.
Because I'm actually here alone too. The entire front page of Google when I was searching for urban legends in Virginia was about the Bunny Man. And so this is a little spooky.
I've heard of this.
You've heard of it.
Yes, because on the and that's why we drink. They did this one actually pretty recently.
Oh, really?
I wondered if it came up.
So, do you like?
Yeah.
Is it fresh in your mind that you can kind of jump in here?
Well, I can try, but it's been a few weeks, and I've been extremely stressed at work, so I probably will have forgotten half of it. But it's just, I heard this because one of the hosts is from it's a local urban legend for them. And so I didn't know that it was going to be like the most popular in Virginia. That's funny.
Well, why don't you share what you know or what you remember? Because then we'll walk through the story.
Well, I remember the most, honestly, is that it was like there was more than one. Like, some people said it was like a person in a bunny costume. And then there was other theories that it was a cryptid. And it wasn't like, but completely decided one way or the other, that it was just kind of like one of those was up in the air. But I know that it's not pleasant. Like, I want to say there's like some pretty ugly, gruesome, gory murders that happen, or like that sort of
lovely
that sort of lore in a way.
Right. No, that's pretty good.
Right.
I actually didn't come across anything that said it was a cryptid, but you're exactly right in the fact that like there are multiple stories that all kind of lead back to the same urban legend.
Oh, nice.
So, I would also like to celebrate the fact that it's only been like 2 weeks from the time that I did this research, whereas normally it's like five or six. So while it will still be a surprise to me, just like all of you, because I have slept since then, I might remember a little bit. So I just feel as though we should give
cheers
to that.
Cheers.
Okay, so here's the legend. Cheers. Cheers. Hold on. Here. Okay. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go through the legend, and then I'm going to go through like a slightly different version because like Tammy said, there's more than one version. And then I'm going to move into some actual research, like true research, not Aaron on the front page of Google research. And I'll explain that when we get there. So hang in because this is kind of a long one, but I hope it's worth it for you. So legend, here we go. And y'all jump in because I can't see you now that I'm on my notes page. Okay. So the legend says, at the stroke of midnight on Halloween, a killer in a white rabbit suit awaits. Lore has that if you speak his name three times, he'll appear. Bunny man. Bunny man. Bunny man.
No.
But don't survive. He'll slash your throat and leave your body dangling from the bridge. Sorry. That's not funny.
All right.
So now I remember the detail there.
So it's the key points here are the bridge and then this like man in a suit. Okay, so these are the key points of this urban legend. So there's not a lot of detail there. Here's a slightly different version. The spirit of an escaped mental patient haunts the railroad bridge. He escaped, hellbent on avenging the murders of his wife and child who were slain nearby. Living in the woods near the bridge, he killed and ate rabbits, wearing their skin and leaving their bodies hanging in the trees. On Halloween night, taunted by town children, he killed and mutilated them too, hanging their bodies from trees around the bridge. In a third version, another spin on the same theme, he's the ghost of an escaped He's the ghost of an escapee of a long-closed nearby asylum. Dressed in a rabbit suit, he throws axes, sometimes chainsaws, sometimes hatchets, depending on the version of the legend, at the cars of young couples who park by the bridge late at night. So three versions there. Extremely scary. Like, yeah. I'm not typically scared by these, and I'm kind of like, wish I had not, like, chosen to be at home alone on the night that we're recording this. But not a lot of detail.
Also, you said it three times.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to catch on to that or if you were going to have a nightmare and call me about 1 a.m.
No. I heard it.
Mm-hmm. So,
He'll stop at your house, not mine.
It's all morbid. Everything I was about to say is morbid, so I'm just going to move on. There's plenty of versions of the Bunnyman Bridge legend. They're all equally scary, which makes this one-lane tunnel. Have you ever seen one of those covered bridges that are one-way? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I've ever been in one, but I've seen them on TV. I know what
you're talking really about. Common in, like, New England, and technically Virginia's not New England, but it's, like, that whole, like, East Coast kind of wraparound piece. Like, some of the older parts of mm-hmm. our country, these kind of bridges are pretty common. Sorry, I just had, like, a pop-up jump in there. And so, like, they're dangerous anyway because you have to be cognizant of, like, making sure that there's no traffic coming from the other direction. But they're also, like, they're really beautiful, but they're kind of scary. So that's the kind of bridge that they're talking about here. So let's see. Okay. So the Bunnyman Bridge was featured in the Fox documentary Scariest Places on Earth and is mentioned innumerable times across the internet. The tale arguably brings commerce to the town of Clifton, Virginia, which is tucked away in the woods between Manassas and Fairfax Station. Pre-pandemic, thousands came to seek a thrill at the Clifton Haunted Trail, which on its website actually features a creepy illustration of a man in a bunny suit. So pretty scary, but is there any truth behind the lore? Brian Conley is a historian archivist for the Fairfax Public Library, and he heard about the Bunny Man all his life. When he returned from college to work in the library system, people kept asking him about this story, and after several people asked him, he sought out to find the truth. So during the time that I was doing this research, I actually found his published article, and though I know it feels kind of like a cop-out to not do my own extensive research, I'm going to share his research with you for a couple of reasons. One, it's complete. Two, it's conducted in a true scholarly format, which puts my general internet research to shame. So it's properly cited, it's done in detail, it's been peer reviewed. Like, this is a true research article, so hang in there. Everything that you're going to hear next is directly taken from Brian Conley's published dissertation, The Real Life Origins of an Urban Legend. So get ready. That's when I said this was a little bit more well-researched. It's because I didn't do it. Okay, so here we go. Are you laughing at me? I don't blame you. Okay. There's a story that a man, this is coming from Brian Conley's article, but I would like to mention for anyone out there who has done any scholarly research that it's generally not a best practice to say I in a scholarly article. Okay, moving on. There's a story that a man dressed as a bunny haunts the residential neighborhoods around our nation's capital. Silly as this sounds, the Bunny Man has been a fixture of local legend for at least 30 years. By 1973, the so-called Bunny Man had been reported in Maryland and in the District of Columbia. His infrequent and widespread appearances tend to occur in secluded locations and usually tell of a figure clad in a bunny suit armed with an axe, threatening children or vandalizing property. By the 1980s, the Bunny Man had become an even more sinister figure with several gruesome murders to his credit. Though he has been reported as far south as Culpeper, Virginia, his main haunt has been the area surrounding the railroad overpass near Fairfax Station, Virginia, frequented by partygoers, the now infamous Bunny Man Bridge. For more than 25 years, stories of the Bunny Man have been kept alive primarily amongst our teenage population. Over the years, the story has evolved into a ghost story which is suitable for parties, campouts, and any occasion that such tales are exchanged. And it was at one such gathering in 1976 that the author first heard it told. The Bunny Man was said to be responsible for the deaths of two disobedient children in the Clifton area. Others were rumored to have disappeared, and there was talk of animals found horribly mutilated. I never saw the bunny man myself, but then I never stayed in the woods at night, especially near the bridge. Most childhood ghost stories are forgotten as one gets older. However, the bunny man followed me. After graduating from college, I accepted a position with the Fairfax County Public Library, eventually becoming an information specialist in the Virginia room. One day in 1992, a well-spoken young lady came into the room with a question. She wanted to know how she could find information on a murder that took place near her home, or that supposedly took place near her home. As I interviewed the patron to ascertain what hard facts she had to go on, a vague memory nagged me. Two children were allegedly murdered by a local hermit for trespassing, and their bodies left hanging from a covered bridge. She had no names, only a vague idea of a time frame. The whole story seemed a little fantastic, but the thing that really bothered her was that the guy was supposed to be an escaped inmate dressed in a bunny suit. At this time, even though the story had evolved a bit, I recognized the tale from my own youth. We were unable to confirm any of the elements of the story, as she or I had first heard it, and I put it down in my mind as a story fabricated to scare children. Now, I likely would have forgotten about the bunny man again if the questions didn't begin coming in on a regular basis. The Bunny Man has begun appearing in print in recent years, having been mentioned in several high school newspapers, and more recently on the internet. The various internet versions have carried the story to new heights. The most widely circulated written versions, entitled The Clifton Bunny Man and signed by Timothy C. Forbes of Virginia, was posted on a website called Castle of Spirits in around 1999. This version is actually quite notable because of the specific facts given. Forbes claims that in 1904, inmates from an insane asylum escaped while being transferred to Lorton Prison. One of these escapees, Douglas J. Grifton, murdered fellow escapee Marcus Walster and eventually became the Bunny Man. Not only is the location identified, but the names of several victims and the dates of the murders are present. The story ends with a challenge for the reader to check with the Clifton Town Library for verification of the facts. So, let me jump out of the story. What do you guys think so far?
So, that last part, you just said there are verified murders.
So, this was posted on a website. This was posted on a website in 1999, and that version of the tale gives a specific year, gives specific details, gives specific names of both the Bunny Man himself and some victims, and then challenges the reader to check in this specific library for a verification of the facts.
Gotcha. So this is not the researcher saying that he's verified. Got it. Okay.
This is the author citing a source and sharing what that source said. Now, he goes on to explain it a bit in a minute, but I wanted to give you guys a chance to weigh in because I know that I am doing kind of a monologue here.
Got it. I just was sitting here thinking that this is not the first time that we've heard of an escaped mental health patient becoming a urban legend, or that being related.
Yeah, that was your New York story, wasn't
it? Yeah, that seems...
New York was definitely one, and I want to say there was another one I did. Or maybe I had just seen it and thought, I've already done this.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Maybe.
But yeah, New York Propsy definitely was that same type of story.
What do you think, Manda?
I think that I have nothing deep or interesting to say. I just am sitting here hoping that I don't see a bunny in my dreams tonight.
You're not going to. You're going to be absolutely fine. We're going to get all these demons out while we're awake, and you're going to sleep perfectly. All right, let's go back into it. So we ended that where this posted article online challenges people to go to the Clifton Town Library and check the facts. So we're back in the story. Little effort was required to show that all of the specifics given in the Forbes version are completely false. First, there's never been an asylum for the insane in Fairfax County. Second, Lorton Prison did not even come into existence until 1910, and even then it was an arm of the District of Columbia Correction System, not Virginia's. Third, neither Grifton nor Walster appear in the court records of Fairfax County. And lastly, there is not, nor has there ever been, a Clifton Town Library. So I left that in as a bit of a cautionary tale. because as we've seen, you know, not to go too far on my own opinions here, but as we've seen over the last few years, a lot of people will say like, oh, I did my own research. I think it's really important to note that just because you have utilized a Google search engine, that does not mean that you have conducted your own research, because this article was posted online. It had a specific citation and it was posed as truth. And this author of the dissertation that we're sharing from was very quickly able to discredit that, but it required some actual work through a scholarly format, which we know not everyone is doing. So there's Erin's two cents on academic research.
Not everything you read on the internet is accurate.
I once did a presentation where I had a picture of Abraham Lincoln and it says, everything that you read on the internet is true. And we quoted it to Abraham Lincoln. And that was the whole point, is like, you can say whatever you want.
Oh, God.
So this story received wide recognition. How many people were like, yes. What's that?
No, I'm just thinking to myself, how many people in their heads were like, wow, he's so wise.
Exactly. Abraham Lincoln's so smart. Okay, so this story about the posting received wide recognition after being featured on national television. Now, the program was called Scariest Places on Earth. It was broadcast on the Fox Family Channel and included a segment entitled Terror on Bunnyman's Bridge in the 2001 broadcast season. Even though these fictional tales of spectacular crimes are easy to dismiss at first, or easy to dismiss as fiction, pardon me, the question of the story's origin is not. So was the Bunny Man real? At first, I was content to dismiss the Bunny Man as completely fictitious. However, I've learned that legends do have a basis in factual events, and at the urging of a fellow employee, I began a more serious search for the Bunny Man. I started with a few basic assumptions. First, though the tale is told in jurisdictions all around Washington, D.C., the bulk of them take place in Fairfax County. Second, any event that gains as much notoriety as this one must have originally been reported to the public. Third, the original event was likely criminal in nature. Logical, right? So, was the Bunny Man a murderer? The aspect of the Sounds story like... which gets the most... Go ahead, sorry. It's really hard not to talk over people with the three channels. What'd you say?
Oh, I was just saying it sounds like...
I'm going to go ahead and guess yes.
Yes. And that makes sense to me too, right? Like if something is this evil and like antagonistic, like there's probably some crime associated. So the aspect of the story which gets the most attention are the alleged murders. Researching historical crimes can be difficult. Pardon me. Unless you have basic facts to begin with. Since police records are not available for casual review and court records are indexed by the name of those involved, not by a location or type of crime, I had to begin by checking the local newspapers. The tool that proved the most valuable was the Fairfax County Public Library Historical Newspaper Index. I'm going to skip through some of these details. So Fairfax County was a rural farming community until well into the 20th century, when there were over 550 individual mentions of killings in the study period, eliminating run-of-the-mill domestic murders and concentrating on multiple murders and those involving children, which luckily were rare. It served to pare down a list of more than 500 possible events to three. So we have, if the Bunny Man legend is true, we have three possible stories. You ready for him?
Down from 500?
Okay. Out of 500. 500 was the original count, and then they kind of cross-referenced time frame specific details, and they were able to pare it down to three possible stories.
Gotcha.
Okay, story number one.
I think I'm ready.
You're ready. Story number one, Francis and June Hobler, February 1949. It would be hard to imagine a more disturbing event for a growing community like Fairfax than the gruesome murders of 37-year-old Frances Hobler and her 8-month-old daughter, June. On Thursday, February the 24th, 1949, Mrs. Hobler and her daughter drove to Fairfax County in the company of her estranged husband, Charles. All were residents of the District of Columbia. Charles Hobler later told police they had come to see the new lodge at a nudist colony to which Mr. Hobler belonged. There you go, sir.
Okay.
Upon leaving, look, there's no accounting for people's choices. Upon leaving the lodge, the car became mired in some mud. The couple quarreled, and Mrs. Hobler took the child and walked away from her husband and never returned. Charles Hobler spent the night in the car and got a ride back to Washington the next day. He returned with his brother-in-law and a friend to retrieve the car. Finding no evidence of his family, the police were finally notified. As an intensive search of the area was organized involving Fairfax County Police, Washington detectives, and the Boy Scouts, because we bring children in to solve crimes. At 5 o'clock, Stan, Justin, what's that?
I said standard.
Yeah, I've never heard of the Boy Scouts being used. Like, maybe I should take that out because I sounded really, really sarcastic, but I've never heard of the Boy Scouts being used as an official, like, investigation. Mom's probably listening, and she's like, actually, they have survival skills. Okay. About 5 o'clock, just as the searchers were about to give up for the night, one of the detectives noted the ground on which they were standing was extremely soft. Both mother and daughter were found in a shallow grave next to the lodge and less than 200 yards from where Charles Hobler's car had been stuck. Frances had been beaten and shot once in the head and the heart, and the baby girl had been buried alive.
Good Lord.
I know. I feel like I probably
I didn't order this off the menu, ma'am. But I did not order this off the menu.
I mean, I did the research, but I didn't order it either. So the local community was shocked and horrified, obviously, due to the cold, brutal nature of the crime, and especially afterwards when the investigation obviously identified Charles Hobler as the prime suspect. He did later confess to investigators that he planned the murder for weeks and had not intended to report the disappearance of his wife, but changed the plan when the car got stuck in the mud, so it kind of screwed up everything for him. The case went to trial in January. He did admit to it. So they pinned it on him, and then he did eventually admit to it. After 4 days of testimony, he was found guilty and was sentenced to die in the electric chair. His attorney filed an appeal alleging that the jury failed to give proper consideration to a plea of insanity. And the Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals eventually overturned the conviction and ordered a new trial. So at that point, Charles Hobler was recommitted to the Western State Mental Hospital at Marion, Virginia, where he was judged to be insane. And it's interesting to note that this is the first time since the Ridgway murder trial of 1927, in which Fairfax County invoked the death penalty. So if you're familiar with Virginia law at all, it's a little piece of interest. I'd also like to point out that since we're directly quoting from a dissertation, I'm using the language that's present, although we know like some of these terms are not really words or phrases that we would use now to describe some of these situations. I'm pulling directly from a source, so forgive me if I misspeak. So that's case one. Option two. Minnie Loretta and Catherine Ridgway, 1927. So if you were paying attention a moment ago, where it says this was the first time since the Ridgway murder trial of 1927 when they invoked the death penalty. Well, now we're going to talk about that case. So, March 1927. The available newspapers record many murders, but few shocked Fairfax like the ferocious and senseless attack on Mrs. Minnie Ridgway and her two young daughters. Mrs. Ridgway lived with her husband and three children on Telegraph Road in Alexandria. Sometime on the morning of March 4th, 1927, a man later identified as Louis Borsig called at the home under the pretext of seeing Mr. Ridgway. Upon finding he was not at home, Borsig attacked and beat Minnie Ridgway into unconsciousness and likewise bludgeoned her two daughters. He then stole money and fled. This crime was discovered by a neighbor who heard sounds coming from inside the house. All three victims were taken to Alexandra Hospital, where Loretta later died. Catherine Ridgway lived another 8 days before succumbing to her injuries, and Minnie recovered and was able to identify the assailant who was known to the Ridgways. Borsig was arrested at his home and transferred to the jail in Winchester for his safety. Louis Borsig was executed for the murders of Loretta and Catherine Ridgway on July 7th, just 3 months after his horrific crime. Okay, so that was options number one and two, and here's option number three. Eva Roy, August 1918. Peter Roy was a Danish immigrant who had come to Fairfax from Minnesota in 1912. In November of that year, he purchased two parcels of land near the current intersection of Old Keene Mill Road and Seidensticker Road, which totaled 184 acres. Roy, a widower, became a prosperous farmer and an active member of the Lee Chapel Methodist Church, and with him resided his eldest daughter, Caroline, her husband, William, and his youngest daughter, Eva. On the morning of August 4th, 1918, Eva Roy, who was 14, left her home near Burke around 9 a.m. to tend her father's small herd of cows. When Eva failed to return home that evening, her father began a search. Neighbors were enlisted to help, but it was 24 hours later that her body was found tied to a tree in the woods near the house, her apron strings around her throat. The county coroner concluded that the girl had been assaulted before being strangled to death. A coroner's jury was appointed and quickly concluded, "We, the jury, find that Eva Roy came to her death at the hands of an unknown person, and the indications pointed to Lou Hall as the likely perpetrator of the crime. Hall was a 33-year-old woodcutter who lived about a half mile from the scene and was seen in the woods near the time of the girl's disappearance. The case was not easily solved, however, as other suspects were soon identified and then later eliminated. So, of those, the first, William Wooster, age 16, was arrested for assaulting another girl. He had been released recently from an insane asylum, but was found that he was nowhere near the scene of Eva's murder. The next suspect was a soldier who deserted from Camp A.A. Humphreys, which is now Fort Belvoir. The soldier, a sergeant whom the papers failed to name, was located days later near Charlottesville, Virginia. He had scratches on his face, was wearing freshly laundered clothes, and claimed to have no memory of the events between leaving Camp Humphreys and his capture. Sheriff Allison traveled to Charlottesville to interview the man, but after some weeks of investigation, determined he was not connected with the crime. The lagging investigation seemed to finally break with the apprehension of Ben Rubin, an escaped inmate from Lorton Prison. Rubin, who had been serving a 3-year sentence for housebreaking, was arrested by Washington, D.C. police on September 19th for assaulting a little girl. While on the way to the police station, he confessed to Eva's murder. He claimed that he met Eva Roy while she was looking after her father's cows. He asked her for food, and in conversation with her, mentioned that he was an ex-convict. She declared she would turn him up, and he became excited and choked her. Washington authorities were unconvinced by Rubin's story and wanted to try him for assault and theft before turning him over to the Virginia courts. An investigator sent the Commonwealth of Virginia to interview Rubin, concluded he was not responsible for the crime, but extradition papers were filed anyway. On September 26, Rubin was escorted to the scene of the crime by the sheriff. After being able to locate the scene or the attack or the tree where the body was found, Rubin then denied killing Eva. He claimed that the presence... of the girl's father spurred him to recant his confession. His motive for confessing was revealed a few weeks later, when October 6th he escaped from the jail and was arrested while bearing a pistol and admitted he concocted his whole story in order to be transferred to Fairfax, where he thought escape might be easier. He was eventually convicted of burglary and escape from jail and was sentenced to 4 more years in prison. Lou Hall was finally tried for the murder. The prosecution was handled by the state attorney, and the defense was provided by Walter T. Oliver. His first trial resulted in a hung jury with 9 votes for guilty, 3 for innocent, and the second trial resulted in a clear verdict of not guilty. Peter Roy died in January of 1938 and was interred in Lee Chapel Cemetery next to his youngest daughter, and her murderer was never found. So after scrutinizing the 3 events, I concluded that none are likely candidates for the Bunny Man. Charles Hobler was caught and incarcerated, Louis Borsig was caught and then executed, and the murder of Eva Roy, although it has many elements that a legend could build upon, is just simply too old. So the last assertion is based upon one other factor that has emerged through the research. The Bunny Man, like any good legend, has evolved over time. The recent rash of persons researching the origin of the story has been largely attracted by the fact of spectacular nature of the alleged crime. The previously cited Forbes version of the story features 32 victims, and it has a pronounced supernatural element, which, of course, contrasts sharply with versions of the tale that I collected, which generally involved between 1 and 3 victims, most likely, or not most likely, usually children. More importantly, the earliest versions did not mention any death. The earliest versions recount acts of vandalism or couples parked at the secluded Lover's Lane location, being accosted and then threatened by a strange individual. More research was clearly needed. After 8 years of research, I finally got a solid lead. The November 11th, 2000 Washington Post ran an article highlighting an interesting collection called the Maryland Folklore Archive. From the 1950s through 1990, students at 3 different Maryland universities collected, researched, and transcribed numerous local legends. This material has finally come to rest in the holdings of the University of Maryland. So in 1973, a student at the University of Maryland named Patricia Johnson submitted a paper titled The Bunny Man. This paper was compiled as a part of the coursework for a class entitled Introduction to Folklore. She ran qualitative research and interviewed 33 students from Prince George's County in Maryland, ages 15 to 18. She relates that the tale met all of the qualifications of an urban belief tale. Specifically, it takes place in an urban setting, it existed prior to her project, and had appeared in print as truth. She goes on to state that included in this collection is an article from the Washington Post, which verifies the story as truth. And this was an important claim, as I had found no primary sources to date. I was extremely frustrated to find that the paper contained the referenced article that was missing from the original paper. So with any hope of a quick resolution gone, I turned to examining the paper itself. Johnson's informants told 54 variations of the tale, a rough tally included, 14 different geographic locations, 18 involved the bunny man chasing or frightening people, usually children with a hatchet or an axe, 14 tell of attacks on cars, 9 claim he attacked a couple parked in a car, 5 accuse him of vandalism on homes or building, and only 3 of those stories mentioned a murder. So based on the widespread geographic location and the variation represented in the tale, Johnson concluded that the Bunny Man was an urban belief tale. So in short, the Bunny Man did not exist. Now we're getting to a breakthrough. Mm. I know this is long, so hang in there. So after rereading Johnson's paper several times, I finally noted she heard the tale for the first time around Halloween of 1970. Having no better leads, I began a systematic search of the Washington Post in hopes of finding the previously cited article. I was elated and not a little surprised to find the following. Man in bunny suit sought in Fairfax. Fairfax County said yesterday, this is an actual news article that I'm quoting now, that they are looking for a man who likes to wear a white bunny rabbit costume and throw hatches through car windows. Air Force Academy cadet Robert Bunny told police that shortly after midnight last Sunday, he and his fiancée were sitting in a car when a man in a white suit with long bunny ears ran from nearby bushes and shouted, "You're on private property and I have your tag number." The rabbit threw a wooden-handled hatchet through the front car window, the first-year cadet told police.
Oh my God.
As soon as he threw the hatchet, the rabbit skipped off into the night. Bennett and his fiancée were not injured. Police say that they have the hatchet but no other clues. So when I started this project, the aspect that puzzled me most was this bunny suit. I expected to find that the legend was spawned by an event that was strange or notable, but I never suspected that the bunny man was really a bunny man. I was further surprised to find a second appearance that was recorded 2 weeks later. The news article was titled, "The Rabbit Reappears." A man wearing a furry rabbit suit with 2 long ears appeared again on Guinea Road in Fairfax County, this time wielding an axe and chopping away at the roof support on a new house. Less than 2 weeks ago, a man wearing what was described as a rabbit suit accosted 2 persons in a parked car and heaved a hatchet through a closed window. These people were not hurt. Thursday night's rabbit, wearing a suit described as gray, black, and white, was spotted a block away. Paul Phillips, a private security guard for a construction company, said he saw the rabbit standing on the front porch of a new but unoccupied home. "I started talking to him," Phillips said, "and that's when he started chopping." "All you people trespass around here," Phillips said, the rabbit told him as he whacked 8 gashes in the pole. "If you don't get out of here, I'm going to bust you on the head." Phillips walked back to his car to get his handgun, but the rabbit carrying the handled axe ran off into the woods. The security guard reported that the man was about 5'8", 160 pounds, and appeared to be in his early 20s. So, in Fairfax County, there were two documented appearances by a bunny-suited figure around the same time. Was this the bunny man? Was it copycats acting out stories? As I mentioned, referencing back to Johnson's paper, there were 14 tales of her story that mentioned couples being parked in cars, but nine of these specifically mention a hatchet being thrown. Of the five mentioning vandalism, two describe columns being chopped. Okay, I'm going to move into the official reports. So that was, those two news articles were published reports, and we're now moving down to official police reports. So the Fairfax County Police Department had no official record of these assaults or the vandalism incidents, although they are not required to release any information relating to misdemeanor offenses. So it is possible they have something, but they did supply a redacted copy of a report for this article. And the investigation confirms the basis as being told out on the Washington Post article that on October 29th, 1970, six officers responded to that same road for a subject dressed as a rabbit with an axe. And that's the extent of the police report. So kind of interesting. So random.
I wish I understood this. Bunny costume.
I don't know. It's
supposed to be
going in so many directions, right? Like there's this urban legend, which is terrifying. And then there's like, you dig into it and there's like three possible suspects that if it's coming from something historical. And then there's like these two, like, are they copycats? Is this the actual case? And these are like, this is like someone just causing mischief. So.
And why are they throwing axes?
I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like they should not be throwing axes.
I agree. So we're going to move in. We're getting here to the end. You've been a champ to hang in with me. So who was the bunny man, right? Like, that's the question we're asking. And what on earth was he trying to accomplish? So sadly, we will likely never know his identity. It happened too long ago. There's too many things going on. But his true motivations are really only known to himself. But there are a few clues contained in the foregoing sources. So we know on October 18th, the bunny man accosted Robert Bennett for trespassing. On October 29th, the bunny man told the security guard, "You all trespass around here." And on November 4th, he styled himself as the Axe Man and accused an unnamed representative of a local subdivision for dumping debris on his property. So there was a third one that I kind of skipped through because the research was getting very, very extensive. Okay, so as a conclusion, let's just skip right to the end. Okay, so who the bunny man was and what motivated him to act in such bizarre manners is still a mystery. However, the available evidence points to the 1970 October events as the most likely genesis of the bunny man legend. So those would be the vandalism acts rather than any gruesome murders. Many of the tales collected by Patricia Johnson. That makes me a little bit better. Say that again.
No, I just said that'll help me sleep a little bit better.
Right, that he was just someone causing mischief. So many of the tales collected by Patricia Johnson, which was the woman in Maryland who did the qualitative research, most of her stories derive from the events as reported to the newspaper and television news, so kind of the mischief maker. And the official police reports make no mention of any pre-existing stories that this individual could have been copying. So to kind of drill that down, essentially like those three possible cases for the gruesome murders at the beginning, there's nothing on record tying that to a bunny man. That was just the researcher trying to find kind of a, like an origin story for where this could have come from. But it's looking like through the context of this research, the most likely origin was actually this man who physically put on a costume and then was causing mischief and vandalism. But it is plainly evident that the story takes on the features of an urban legend quite soon after the events were reported. So, Investigator Johnson was following leads generated by these schoolyard rumors less than 2 weeks after the first appearance of the bunny man. And by the time that she began her work 2.5 years later, the story had mutated in location, frequency, and severity. And there, my friends, you have one interpretation of a very long story.
An urban legend. So it's like the legend exists and there was at some point this man dressed in this bunny costume playing with weapons for whatever reason, we're not sure.
Right.
But someone tried to tie it back to a true crime that actually did happen, but it's not ever been tied to the Bunny Man.
Right. Did I follow that right? And maybe it didn't happen, right? Like, so three crimes really did happen, and maybe they have nothing to do with it. So it's kind of like this man, the fact that we know is true is a man showed up dressed as a bunny and caused some vandalism in the 1970s. But then there's like schoolyard stories of it having much more of like a campfire tale to it. So this researcher spent a lot of time and a lot of words that I did a very poor job recounting here on this podcast to go all the way back and try to find like a true crime creep factor. And really like all that can statistically be proven is that there was a man who vandalized some property dressed as a rabbit.
But who dresses as a rabbit?
Not me.
And goes and just.
It reminds me of, I think they even said this on when I told you that they told the story on And That's Why We Drink. Mm-hmm. And I think at one point they even mentioned Donnie Darko, which is what I was thinking about the entire time. I don't know if you saw that movie.
I couldn't remember the name of the movie.
Yeah, with the rabbit thing. And like, that's all I could think of is like, because it's like this creepy rabbit.
Right. That's right. Exactly.
So creepy.